We'll call the meeting of Game Fish and Forestry to order. And we need a motion to, do we have the minutes in here? Okay, we need a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Thiessen, so moved. Any discussion, changes, or amendments proposed to the minutes? There being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the motion does prevail on the February 2, 2009 minutes of this committee. The first item is House File 304, Representative Hackbarth, either sex bill on deer for recently discharged services members. Representative Cornish, you move that bill for Representative Hackbarth?
I'll move it.
Okay, Representative Cornish moves House File 304.
Okay.
And that is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Well, we have also Representative Magnus before us as well. Representative Hackbarth and Magnus, welcome, and go ahead with the presentation on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 304, you know, I hate to use the old cliche about how this is so simple, but it really is very, very simple. It's already in law that residents that were recently discharged from military service, that they get a free deer license, and all this does is also gives them a doe permit along with the free deer license. What's happening, Mr. Chairman, is that folks are overseas, they're discharged, they come back and they want to go deer hunting, and they haven't applied for the doe permit, and they can get the free deer license, but they're not eligible for a doe permit because they weren't here at the time to apply for the permit. So, Mr. Chairman, all this does is says that when they get their license, they also get a either sex doe permit.
Representative Magnus, what could you possibly add to such a simple bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus is here because he brought me this language. He actually had a constituent in his district that had this issue happen to him, and he couldn't be here today, but Representative Magnus is here to speak on his behalf.
Well, welcome. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Chairman, today is tomorrow's an important day because the Red Bull, the 34th Infantry Division, is having their ceremony to deploy again overseas. And, you know, that's a good point to bring this up because, again, as the Representative Hackbarth said, this was brought to me by a constituent who was serving in Iraq last summer and got out just prior to a deer hunting season and was not able to get a doe permit. So, Mr. Chairman, I got the doe for him, only the problem was I got it with my car.
The tape was turned off then, right about when you said car.
Okay.
Okay, let's hear from the DNR. Who's here from the DNR? Ed, Mr. Bogus? Thank you, Mr. Representative Magnus.
Thank you.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and members, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. And there's another provision of current law that requires that authorizes the commissioner to give preference to veterans in active military service who served outside the United States in the previous 24 months. So, we've been doing that. We have a website and a form where they can download an application and apply and fax it or email it or mail it to us. However, we recognize that those military personnel serving overseas may not always be aware of that or may not be aware in time to apply. So we've become aware of this, I think, through the same constituent, through the Senate Veterans Committee, and have been looking into it, and we don't issue, or we haven't up to this time issued a lot of these free deer licenses to veterans discharged within the previous 24 months who served outside the United States in federal active service. I guess as we're looking into it, we do think that this type of an approach probably makes the most sense rather than giving them preference in the drawing, which another provision of this statute provides, is just to issue them the license that's valid for a deer of either sex, even if they're in a lottery deer area, which is the only place this really comes into play. But much of southwest Minnesota is in that mode. So We think something like this approach makes sense. This is what we currently do for active duty that are home on leave, is they get a free license that's valid for either sex, and probably makes sense to do it similarly for those discharged within the previous 24 months.
Representative Magbar, do you have any idea how many people this would amount to, or Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chairman, I do not, but I'm sure it's very, very minimal.
Mr. Chair, I neglected to grab that information. I had previously provided some similar information to Ms. Taylor, and I don't know if she has it in front of her either, but I know we have not issued a lot of the discharge within the previous 24 months, and I forgot to bring it with me tonight. We can certainly get that. So far, it's been a fairly small number.
Any biological reason not to do it? I don't sound like there is.
Mr. Chair, lottery deer areas are the areas where we're trying to control the harvest of antlerless deer, and we've been having some issues in some of those areas where we've been trying to actually raise the deer population, and we've been having higher than expected harvest of antlerless deer, and a lot of that may be due to some of the youth provisions that authorize either sex, and they tend to be highly successful in those lottery areas. So we have some biological issues in lottery deer areas, but given the numbers that we're looking at for these veterans and the fact that they would be distributed across the lottery deer areas, at least at the level that we've got now, it's not a significant concern.
Okay, questions for Mr. Bogus from any of the members? Okay, being none, let's hear from the deer hunters. Mr. Keller? I just assume you want to get up and speak.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. We don't have a passed resolution or opinion on this particular bill. Our corporate board meeting is in 3 weeks, the 28th of February. I will have more likely a definitive yes or no at that point whether we support the bill. At this point, I don't even have a flavor. I would imagine we'd support it, but just to be clear, I don't have a specific opinion.
You'll get back to Mr. Kadelka with after your meeting?
Pardon me?
You'll get back to Mr. Kadelka on this issue after your meeting?
And a number of others.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Kelleher? There being none, anyone in the audience like to testify for or against the bill? There being none, Representative Cornish renews his motion. We'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Okay, the next bill before the committee is Representative Drozdowski, House File 436.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
And Representative Tal moves House File 436 to get it before us. Representative Drozdowski, welcome, and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill basically restores 2 days to the first season in the Zone 3 deer hunting zone, and adds one of the weekends back that was taken off of the season about, as I understand, back in 2003 through the rulemaking process. And it also really identifies, and if you would, codifies the current Zone 3 deer hunting structure, one season beginning around that November 6th and one beginning around November 20th. This would make for two separate 9-day seasons. Right now, there's a 7-day season on the early season and a 9-day season on the second season. The issues that really, if I could, Mr. Chair, kind of underpin this, and you'll hear more from the folks from Minnesota Deer Hunters Association and some of the folks from Southeast Minnesota that have come up to testify today. But the demographics and the makeup of deer hunting in Southeast Minnesota, it's largely an area that's owned in private land, and so the 2-week season really lends itself very well to that, and you'll hear more from that today. And there's just a sense that as we look at what has been considered and is being considered even in the future in terms of some of the management approaches of the agency, there really seems to be a greater focus in that Southeast region on fostering the development of big bucks in the area at the expense of freedoms for people to have that longer first season, which really helps us out with the youth hunt, which many of us believe is very important, and certainly helps us reach the goal of dealing with an overpopulated deer herd in southeast Minnesota. I passed out, the gentleman's passing out right now, some excerpts, if you will, from the 2005 survey by the DNR that surveyed deer hunters throughout Minnesota. And if I could just go through those quickly, Mr. Chair. The first one on page 12 really looked at people's approach to hunting. Do they hunt for bucks or do they hunt for deer generally? If you add the first three columns for Southeast, that's about 40% of the hunters that hunt for bucks in one form or another, and about 60% that really aren't out there hunting for bucks or hunting for deer. The next page, page 18, this particular table looked at the satisfaction back in 2004, I believe is when the survey must have happened. It was published in 2005. 73% of the hunters in southeast Minnesota, if you combine those first two columns, were satisfied with the deer hunt, and 15% were not. And page 22, the next page, the indication of satisfaction with success as measured by whether or not they killed a deer that season, 67% were satisfied in southeast, 19% were not, 14% were neither or. The next page, page 23, it looks at whether or not people believed that they had seen or heard about big bucks in the area that they hunt. And if you add the first two columns, a strongly agree and slightly agree for southeast, 61% said that they agree that they had seen or heard of big bucks in the area. 29% said they had not, or there was a lower amount. The next page, page 24, about an even amount in terms of the satisfaction referring to the quality of bucks in the area they hunt, an equal amount that agree to those that disagree. The table below on the same page, percent agreement with hunter satisfaction regarding the number of mature bucks in the area they hunt, 41% agreed, 48% disagreed. I may be going too fast for members. I apologize if I'm not. I don't want to take too much of your time. But page 33, the next page, support for different regulatory alternatives presented by the agency in the form of the survey. The one that really was begun by removing these 2 days was the moving the season out of the rut. It moved a portion of the season out of the rut by removing the one weekend from the A season. And if you add the first two columns, 28% supported moving it out of the rut and 54% opposed. Moving, Mr. Chair and members, to the last page, page 36 on the bottom, very similar question. Percent indicating support for moving the firearm deer season out of the rut, 34% were in southeast. This is by different areas of the state. So in southeast, 34% were, if you add the first two columns, were in favor of it, and 49% opposed, which is varies a little bit from the average throughout the state, but still pretty close. So the question that I would pose in the discussion and leading on to our other testifiers is where and how did we get to the goal of being managing for antlers in southeast Minnesota rather than sticking with a season that was working very well and providing opportunities for people broadly with their families to experience and participate in and to perpetuate the American tradition of deer hunting. With that, Mr. Chair, if you have any questions, otherwise there are some other testifiers here as well.
Welcome.
Hello. Well, Chair Dill and committee members, my name is Kevin Osmond. I'm the Southern Regional Coordinator of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I live in Eden Prairie. Our headquarters is actually in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. We have a statewide organization of about 18,000 members. We've been in existence since 1980. Our organization's goal is to look after the best interests of Minnesota's deer herd and also on behalf of Minnesota's deer hunters. Our executive director, executive board, and MDHA as an organization support the reinstatement of the 9-day season in Zone 3 as prior to the change about 5 years ago. Our main reason is there was not a biological reason for change by rule of the DNR back then, and we feel it's time to reinstate that season to 9 days, provide that extra few days for Minnesota's hunters and their kids. It's an abundant resource. Let's go ahead, and it's time to come back to that 9-day season. And further, we'll have a testimony by Bluff Country Chapter of Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. They'll be sharing their views. Thank you so much.
Any questions for the next testifier?
Chairman Dill, welcome.
What's your name for the record?
My name is James Ponick. I live in Family Farm in Dakota, Minnesota, which is down by Winona. I work in Winona in a factory, but I grew up on the farm. That's where I still live, on the family farm. With the chair's permission, I'd like to go over a little history of when this 2 days was taken away. In 2003, there was some pressure put on the DNR by special interest groups within our area to take a look at the structure of the deer herd and for better quality bucks. The DNR had public input meetings, I believe four. I attended the one in Winona, and I believe there was 450 people present at that meeting. We had it at the junior high school. The place was packed. People were allowed to speak on behalf or against the bill, and there was several people spoke that night, and I'm not sure. I think the DNR maybe did a survey that night, never heard what the results were, but in my opinion, when I was there, there was overwhelming support to keep the DNR, the 3A season at 9 days at that time.
I have a question.
Yes.
A moment ago you said the meeting was, and they spoke to the bill.
No,
you're referring to, you said bill, but you meant the DNR.
Yeah, I meant the, at that time, they were talking about changing the season.
Right, I thought you maybe referring to that you had a meeting and spoke to this bill.
No, not this bill.
Fine.
This is when, the history of when the 2 days were taken away back in 2003.
I got that. Thank you.
At that time, there were several people that spoke. I just want to give you a little history of what happened. There was two school buses full of kids that came from Caledonia, Minnesota. I'm not sure if you guys, anybody here knows where it is. It's in the southeast corner. There was approximately 50 kids that came on these buses, and they each had a speaker come up and speak on the behalf of the students from Caledonia. One was a young girl, and she got up and she addressed the DNR, and she said, it was kind of interesting. She said to him, what did I ever do to you? And the DNR said, what do you mean? Well, you're taking away half of my hunting season. And if you know what schools are nowadays, you cannot get out of school to hunt deer. It's a big no-no, not even if the parents sign for it. So the other person, the kids stood up, and they also spoke to keep it where it was. Don't take away half of our deer season. These kids all hunt with their families. They hunt in 3A. You know, the reason to go and hunt 3B to get the days isn't going to work when you hunt with your family. That's when they hunt. So it was pretty overwhelming when you could see these kids come to this meeting and get up and stand and talk in front of a big crowd and speak on behalf to keep the season there. Well, after the meetings were all done, our local DNR person, MDHA thought this wasn't going to happen. It was going to be 9 days. And lo and behold, by rule, it was changed to 7, and we lost the 2 days. MDHA Bluff Country Chapter got bombarded by our members. What happened, and we couldn't really explain why it happened. So it went on. We left the goal for a while. And then in 2006, there was word out that the DNR was being pressured again to move the season back back a week and reduce it to 5 days. And at that time, we discussed let's do a petition and see what kind of support we really have out there. So we took a few of our members and we went out, and in 2 months, we got over 1,000 names signed on this petition, to get restore the 2 days. We sent this off to all the local, or the head DNR people and our local legislators, and basically didn't even get a response back on it. And that's kind of what's bringing where we're at right now, from my point. So that's what I got to say. Anybody else have anything else, Mr. Chairman?
Questions by the members of the testifier. Okay, and the next testifier, are you Mr. Newton?
Mr. Nolan, yeah.
Oh, Nolan?
Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman. I'm Jim Nolan. I'm the chapter president, and believe me, it's a full-time job trying to keep track of these guys. Trying to bring the reins in once in a while. I'm one of the forerunners of this bill. My feeling is that with had I received a copy of that petition with over 1,000 names on it, I would have done something about it. I mean, it speaks for the constituents of that area. The DNR chose, for some reason, not to do anything. It just sat on it. Whether they hope it's going to hatch into something good or not, I don't know. That's for them to answer. I guess Mr. Ponick took part of my thunder, but that's fine. When I look at it from the overall, because of my disability, I can only hunt for 2 days. I hunt the 3A season simply because the weather doesn't allow me to hunt the 3B season. Plus, the people I hunt by, who are good enough to let me hunt, my son and I, they hunt the 3B season, so I really don't have a choice on it. But as it is, I can only hunt for 2 days because my son has to take me out, drive me within about 30 feet of my deer stand, and drops me off. I can't hunt there during the week because my son is active duty Army at Fort McCoy and he has to be at work. Restoring the weekend, the second weekend, would actually give me 2 more days to hunt. That'd be 4 days that I could hunt. I look at it in the light that I buy a license. Right now, I can hunt for 2 days. A bow hunter buys a license, he can hunt for 4 months, to 3.5 months, whatever it is, 120, 112, whatever. The extra weekend, you know, I don't care how long they want to hunt, but it should be nice if I could hunt for 4 days.
Any questions for the testifier, Mr. Nolan? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nolan, I just wanted to clarify. Actually, we changed last year. The deer license is good statewide now, and you actually could hunt 3 weekends in Zone 1 with your license. So you actually no longer... Oh, that's not true for 3B, though, if he goes to 3B, is
no.
it? You hunt 3A, right? But in your 3A license, you would be able to hunt up in Zone 1 the next 2 weekends if you and your son wanted to go and... Representative Bill's got lots of great public hunting up there because I'm one of them that go up there.
Well, first of all, I have to find somebody in Zone 1 that I know that would let me hunt. I don't see any reason for it. Why put on the extra miles when I wouldn't have to? Yeah, if I can hunt for 4 days, I'm perfectly happy.
Well, you probably don't have to find somebody you know to come hunting up where we live. But the mileage thing is your issue. All right,
thank
Mr.
You.
Fitch. Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon, Chairman Dill. Perry Fitch, State Director, Bluff Country Chapter, MDHA. Work full-time plus local farmer in the Pickwick area south of Winona. Few problems with the things that are going on. First off, the 2 weekends. I mean, I know a few years ago they put in a youth season. Very nice. A couple-day youth season. The youth season is for a hunter like me to find a kid on the street that parents don't hunt. I shouldn't say on the street, but somebody that don't hunt. And take that kid hunting for the weekend, which I do. The family season to take my children hunting is the family season. That's either 3A or 3B. I do hunt the 3B, but I have, you know, a lot of people that hunt 3A. Their kids hunt with them. They can hunt 1 weekend. I mean, with the school bus ratio we have down there, you get off a bus at 4:30. You don't have time to go hunting.
second thing with that is when southeastern Minnesota is primarily a private land area. There is some public land, but tremendous amounts of the deer habitat is on private land. The deal that I know of myself and many other farmers in the area is you take your circle of farms around you, you allow one set to hunt the 3A, second one to hunt the 3B. It works out very well. You don't end up with landlocked deer. You don't end up with trespass issues. Your neighbors are friends. They all have friends. Everybody hunts. We enjoy the deer drive in southeast Minnesota. That's a big part of it right there. Second part of the thing is we are still overpopulated in southern Minnesota. I realize the deer hunting harvest went down some the last 2 years. Still eighth highest on record. The deal with deer, we're still shooting so-called predation permits. I don't believe in them. I won't buy them. But, I mean, you don't buy them. The DNR gives them to you. You shoot so many deer on your land in August. Currently, they're shooting deer in the orchard zone down there right now. I'm not sure how many. You can't tell if they're bucks or does. But it's due to the overpopulation. Why not have these 2 days added back on? So, you know, there's more deer can be shot. I mean, it may not be a big percentage, but the opportunity is there to shoot the deer. You know, somewhere along the line, southern Minnesota is going to start asking for crop damage. I'm real sure the government doesn't want to look at paying crop damages the neighboring states do. But somewhere that's coming. I have small fields, 2 acres. If you take a 2 acre field and the deer and turkeys eat the outside 4 rows, you lose about 25% of your crop. And that happens. And the other thing to bring up is, when we talked with the DNR over this, Mr. Cornicelli told us there's no biological reason why they took the 2 days off the season. So that, you know, we're not sure. Why take them away? Second thing is always remember, in Minnesota, you're allowed one antlered deer. If you add the 2A's back on that 3A season, you're still allowed one antlered deer. That's it. Whether you bow hunt, gun hunt, muzzleloader hunt, whichever you do, we're still only allowed one antlered deer. So, appreciate your time.
Thank you. Questions for the test farm? Okay, thanks for coming. Next, we have Mr. Hamill. You are not Mr. Hamill.
True. Mr. Hamill, Mr. Bodger. This is about the weather.
Okay, welcome.
So we're moving on to
the
second representative from the Bluffland Whitetails Association.
Okay, very good. Welcome.
Gary Botzik. I'm actually the executive director of the Minnesota Conservation Federation. The Minnesota Conservation Federation has been around since 1936, made up of sportsmen's clubs throughout Minnesota. The Bluffland Whitetail Bluffland Whitetail Association is a member of ours for the last 2-3 years. We've been working with them on the Shining legislation, which was in front of your subcommittee last year, and we hope will be in front of the subcommittee in the near future. The Bluffland Whitetail Association, of course, is different than the Bluff Country chapter, so I just want to make that clear. There's differences of opinion on deer hunting in Minnesota, especially in southeast Minnesota. And I think you're seeing that and hearing that today. I wouldn't call it necessarily Hatfields and McCoys, but it's sometimes close to that. And it's an honest difference of opinion as to how we should manage our deer herds. And it's a very difficult procedure factor because of all the private land compared to what we have in northern Minnesota, access to those public lands, WMAs, etc. Different story down there. And a shotgun slug in most cases, too. But who's in a better position to sort that out? Is it the DNR, who had 4 public hearings on this before they made that change based on survey results back in 2003-2004, or is it 4 public hearings and busloads of people, or is it a legislative committee in a half an hour or an hour hearing? And it's my contention and our contention that this is a management decision that's best left to the DNR. And if you look at the bill, and I appreciate the good legislator bringing it forward, I just learned about it over the weekend myself. If you look at the deer season 97B, you see the commissioner is asked by rule to establish the following deer seasons you look at it, there is a range of dates given there where firearms other than muzzle loaders are held or take place. That season has to take place. Muzzle loader season is a different date. Archery is a different season. They overlap, as you know, in some cases. And finally, there is a provision that the commissioner, again of DNR, may establish special seasons within designated areas at any time of the year. That's all existing law, as you read the bill. The new language there starts to micromanage, and I think you're well aware of that from what you've already heard. We just feel it's better for that management to reside and stay with a Department of Natural Resources, that you pay good money, I might say, for that responsibility. If they're not doing their job, you know, tell them that, ream them out, but I still feel that this is a management decision rather than a legislative decision. And I realize I shouldn't be saying that to legislators, because you have the ultimate weapon, better known as the election certificates. You can do whatever you want, but I'm just giving you my best advice, my suggestions. I attended the DNR roundtable this past January up at Earl Brown. I saw a number of legislators, Representative Hackbarth and others were there. Deer management was a big issue again, as it usually is. And there was a big meeting on Saturday morning, I believe, and DNR heard from some of these same concerns and said, we are willing and able to do sub-meetings, if you will, sub-forums in Southeast and Southwest. And those just haven't occurred yet. Even DNR can't work that fast. And I just think it may be premature to move forward with this legislation until those types of home-type meetings take place, just like what happened in 2003. So with that, there's a couple more comments. Youth hunting, as I understand it, down in 3A and 3B, we didn't lose 2 days. They were shifted from the first season to the second season, so the same amount of days are there. It may be a factor of when their kids are in school or whatever as far as their ability to use those days, but we didn't lose opportunities for the youth. They were just shifted from season one to season two. Still have over 16 days on one tag with a muzzleloader tag and an early antlerless tag. Kids can still hunt for over 34 days total. Work archery in there, it's over 100 days total. So the opportunity is there, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you we shouldn't be promoting youth. We better. We're losing our kids to video games and couch potato scenarios compared to we got to get them outside. But I don't think this necessarily would do that much to move kids into and out to the greater outdoors. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think I better stop and take any questions.
Well, questions from the members? And Mr. Bostic, we always at this committee take the opportunity to ream out the DNR at any chance we get.
I understand.
So speaking of the DNR, Mr. Bogus.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Bogus, welcome again. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Give us a rundown on the why it's 7 days and how you got there. I heard sounds as if there was overwhelming testimony that they wanted to keep it at 9 days. What's the deal with the seven?
Mr. Chair, we have Luke Cornicelli here tonight, also our big game specialist, who was at all of those meetings. I was at some of them, but not all, so I'm going to ask him to help me with this. But just to give a little bit of a quick history and then let Mr. Cornicelli fill in the details. Back in 2003, we decided to try doing some things differently in Zone 3, which is, as you've heard, has a little bit different season structure than anywhere else in the state. And so we had a series of meetings. We had a variety of proposals. We put out some proposals after that first series of meetings, took comments, and then ended up with a final package that has been in effect. And part of the reason for the reduction in the 3A season was to try to reduce the amount of pressure on bucks and to see how that worked. There's also been some testimony tonight about taking away time from youth, which with a 9-day season that starts on a Saturday, obviously you have 2 weekends included, and with a 7-day season it closes on a Friday. So that was a concern. We've since, for all the youth firearms licenses, we've since made those valid in any open firearms season. So actually youth license holders, which are deer hunters under the age of 18, can hunt in 3A and 3B or 1 or 2. There are additional opportunities for youth now than there were the first year after we did this. But maybe if you'd like just a little bit more detail on kind of the outcomes of all those discussions, I don't recall all that off the top of my head. Mr. Cornicelli could provide a little more of that detail.
Well, Mr. Cornicelli, welcome. And specifically to Mr. Boggess said that the one of the desired outcomes was to take some of the pressure off bucks in that area. How has that worked by reducing it to 7 days? Has that been effective?
Mr. Chair, yes. A couple of things. When we went out to the public meetings, the original proposal that was brought forth to float out to the public was actually to shorten the season to 5 days, and that's what we had presented at the public meetings. And Mr. Fix was right. There were about 800 people showed up for 4 public meetings. We came back. We took all that input from that we got. We modified the proposal, then sent it back out and took email comments only. We didn't go back out and do more meetings. And the feeling we got after the second round of public comment was that 7 days was okay. Realizing not everybody was happy, but that's the nature of things. With respect to shifting pressure, there were two things that were actually going on. The 3A, 3B season history is the A season was 9 days and it was bucks only. The B season was a little bit later, it was 7 days and ended on the Friday after Thanksgiving, and that was pretty much known as the doe season. So what we did was we took the 2 days off the A, put them on the B, so it's still 16 days of deer hunting, it's just a little bit different how the structure. But what we also did was we ended buck hunting. We pretty much made most of the area either sex over the counter, managed intensive areas, or either sex by lottery. So there was no such thing as a buck season anymore in 3A. And that's been very effective. We've gone from 100% of the harvest in 3A being bucks now to about 62-64% depending on the year. So we're harvesting almost the same number of deer, if not a few more, and I can get into why. But we have shifted more towards antlerless deer because we put those animals on the table. We are seeing some increases in overall deer harvest because what we have seen is even though we took 2 days off the season, we've seen a shift of people from B to A. And likely that was because of the muzzleloader season with the all-season license. And because if you buy it, it's really confusing and it's hard for me to understand. But if you hunt 3B, you couldn't buy a muzzleloader license. So what we were seeing with the all-season is people were going to A so they could hunt muzzleloader. So their trade-off was they were losing the 2 days willingly, but they were gaining 16 on the muzzleloader end. So we used to have, the breakdown was 55% B, 45% A. Now it's about 50-50. So even though we have a shorter A structure, we have more people hunting that season, which isn't necessarily a bad thing because they're taking antlerless deer. So we do still have population issues with Mr. Fitz's area, 346, 349, but you've also seen the early antlerless hunting that's been pretty effective when it doesn't rain and get a lot of wind, which I can't control. But it has been effective at taking more antlerless deer, and it is a good use tool. We're seeing that in our survey. So we are seeing a shift in harvest, doe harvest to the A, and it is helping manage population. And the 2 days hasn't been moving people away. If anything, it's been a non-issue with respect to participation going the other way. Does that make sense? I talk fast, and that's my East Coast upbringing. I apologize.
I think I got most of it. as the members know, that deer season gets pretty complicated depending on, especially if you get used to one thing where you live, and then somebody calls you and starts talking about something in the opposite end of the
right.
state, which is 350 miles away.
And Mr. Chair, you did a wonderful job simplifying it last year. It was quite easy to explain.
Well, I recall that we didn't take the recommendations of the department for deer simplification, but we implemented our own.
They were wonderful.
Oh, we're having a love fest. They agreed with the first bill. That's almost unbelievable.
It worked out well.
So, Representative Hansen, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Bogus and Corinicelli. How many people are we talking? How many licenses are we talking about in A and B? I don't know if you mentioned that. So, how many licensed deer hunters are there in 3A, and how many in 3B?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, it's we're dealing with about 42,000 people total. And right now, I haven't run the 08 numbers yet, but last year it was about 20 and 20. So about 20,000 A, 20,000 B. So,
Mr. Chair, if dealing with dates and times does the legislature usually get involved in that, or has that mainly been done through rule?
Attorney Kelly. Mr. August.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, the department has, at least for the deer season and every other season I can think of off the top of my head, been given a framework oftentimes within which we could set dates, but the actual dates that are selected have been by rule of the department.
And how about on the, Mr. August, on the, I don't deer hunt. I haven't bought a license in years because I'm always gone to North Dakota duck hunting because everybody's focused on deer. It's great duck hunting when everybody's hunting deer. Anyway, I remember just flipping back and forth between like 9 and 15 days and different things like that. Has that ever been specified over a couple of decades? Has that ever been specified in law, or has that always been within the framework that you suggested?
Mr. Chair, season lengths have varied by zone depending on the vulnerability of the deer and the percentage of public versus private ownership primarily, so that where we have large amounts of public land and deer are not very vulnerable because of forested conditions, we've had the long 16-day seasons, which include three weekends, and in the agricultural areas, which are predominantly private land and deer are very vulnerable, we've had two-day seasons, four-day seasons, nine-day seasons, and that's all been done by rule.
Never by the legislature.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions for the testifier, for the department folks? Is there anyone else in the...
Mr. Chair, if I could just add that Mr. Botzik referred to the roundtable, and I just wanted the committee to be aware that we did commit at the roundtable to doing some regional meetings, as he had said, and talking about these issues. They are complicated. They are somewhat polarized, and we do intend to continue these discussions, at least if we still have the flexibility to set these seasons. So we are committed to doing that over the next several months.
Okay, anyone else? Ms. Kelleher, you have anything to say on this issue?
Okay.
Okay. And, yes, come forward. Mr. House, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't hunt that zone. I am a life member of Minnesota Deer Hunters, so I support most of what's going on with the Deer Hunters Association. I live in Little Canada, Minnesota. Roger Hoff is my name. I've heard a lot of things here about who wants what, and certainly all want to support the kids. The most important element of all of our hunting is the landowner. And I didn't hear much about what the position of the landowner is. I mentioned I didn't hunt that area for deer. I do hunt it for turkey. I have talked to farmers in the area, and very frankly, the farmers I've talked to said no more seasons. They get the spring turkey season for 5 weeks, they get the pheasant season, they get the grouse season, they get the fall turkey season. They pretty well had it. I guess my only concern is we've got to bring the landowner into the picture. And unless we have done that, I don't know that we're ready to take a position on it.
Okay, any questions? Thank you very much. Anyone else like to testify for or against the bill? Okay, Representative Tower renews his motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the...
I had a question for the author.
Oh, can Representative Drozdowski come
Representative Drozdowski, for those folks that are familiar with northern Minnesota and the manufacture of white paper, it's very crucial and helps deer a lot if we make a lot of white paper. But we have a policy around the legislature that we try to print copies on both sides. I see a six-page handout that you referred to that mistakenly was only printed on one side.
Well,
I'll make a point to not ask.
I actually instructed him to do that. Boise Cascade is laying people off up in Northern Minnesota. Additional paper, but you can go ahead now.
Well, Mr. Chair, that was going to be my point. I was going to say I'm not going to ask under whose instructions this was done, because there's this. It's a very two-sided issue that you've decided to only take one side of. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, can I respond?
For the record, I don't know if they're laying off of Boise or not. That was just a...
It is actually, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McNamara, it is a deer management issue. This is a very difficult winter, even, and with our very high population of deer in southeast Minnesota, a lot of trees have been girdled lately, and they're starting to eat the paper-producing trees, and we wanted to make sure that we had plenty of supply.
Anyone else on the bill? All right, Representative Powell renews his motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Drzowski, for coming before us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, now we have the DNR is going to come forward, and Mr. Hammer, are you here? Somewhere? Oh, coming down. All right. And we're going to, as members know, we prescribed in the environment bill last year that the department do an uncased firearms report and report back to the standing chairs for this legislative session. And they have produced a report. And we've also introduced a bill that would allow uncased firearms under certain conditions. And I want to inform the committee that when the bill was introduced, that it included in its language provisions for a loaded firearm. And I just want to inform the committee that when the bill comes before us the first time, that provision will be amended to be an unloaded firearm with no shell in the chamber and no shells in the magazine. There will be other changes as well regarding a clarification on the concealed carry law and whether a person without a concealed carry permit can have an uncased pistol, which I believe it will be not allowed when the amendment comes forward. Also, we will be amending the bill that would say something along the lines of that a city that has a no discharge ordinance, that the firearm will not be allowed to be uncased, whether it's hunting season or not. Be quite a variety of things that we have been contemplating since the bill was first drafted and first introduced. So just for that information for the committee. And so now we'd like Mr. Hammerlin from the department to introduce himself and then go through the report. And does each of the members have a copy of the report? Yeah. It's the one that looks like it's dragnet on the front.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Captain Mike Hammer. I'm the Education Programs Coordinator for the Division of Enforcement and was one of the persons responsible for the report you have in front of you. If we look over the executive summary, some of the things that the report points out is we looked at statistical evidence from our neighboring states. A lot of times in Minnesota, especially when it comes to hunting and outdoor recreation-related activities, we look at what our neighboring states are doing as far as their recreational-type activities and comparing them to our own. I was the one who gave direction to the person who started research on this to use North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Iowa for comparison. I had no idea what the data was going to show until the data was compiled. We looked on page 5 of the report. We have some charts there that show an accident comparison. That's just one of the things we want to look at in the report here. And look at the history of the of uncased firearms in Minnesota, unloaded firearms in Minnesota in relation to motor vehicles. We start off and go to page page one of the report. I'll give you a brief introduction of where we got our data from. We use the International Hunter Ed Association Hunting Incident Clearinghouse for our data. Then we go into historical information. First time we see reference to firearms in motor vehicles is back in 1917. There was first legislation that said it was unlawful for a person to take, shoot, kill birds, animals from a motor vehicle. So there was recognition right away by the legislature back then that firearms and motor vehicles can have an impact on game populations. And we look in there, and back in 1919, they expanded that prohibition to read the firearms had to be unloaded and also cased in a motor vehicle. Again, probably recognized, we don't know the exact reason for that, but the reason was probably the fact that just a firearm that's uncased in a motor vehicle still affords plenty of opportunity for a person to quickly take a shot at a wild animal from that motor vehicle. So they added in another step back in 1919 to add that case provision in there. Look on page two. There was a 1941 Attorney General opinion relating to transportation on case firearms and motor vehicle. There's some questions about whether people who were riding on it or in it had to have their firearms unloaded or cased. And one of the interesting things that was again brought in there in this Attorney General's opinion was the concept of fair chase. And fair chase is, again, going back to that original intent of the legislature, realizing that motor vehicles and firearms in hunting situations offered an opportunity for unfair chase for the game animal. Animals become very accustomed to motor vehicles and using a motor vehicle as a platform to take animals was considered, in this Attorney General's opinion, is not being fair chase. So that's when they first introduced it in speaking about it. Over the years, there's been other modifications made to the statute, including airplanes, restrictions on archery equipment, and also there's been exemptions also applied too for certain situations for handicapped individuals, things like that. The following pages are just a recap of the current statute as it's laid out and also has some reference to federal law and interstate transportation of firearms. Bottom of page three, again, we get back to the fair chase and legislative intent and benefits of the current law. The original intent of the firearms transportation law was to introduce poaching or to reduce poaching opportunities and to provide for fair chase. That intent still holds true today. Poaching from motor vehicles and taking wild animals from private property along roadways has been a problem for private property owners and game managers for as long as there's been motor vehicles in game laws. One of the side benefits that we've seen from this current, or the way the law is written, is we've seen a safety factor there. And as the manager of our safety training programs in Minnesota, I'm very passionate about preventing accidents relating to hunting, particularly firearms accidents relating to hunting, snowmobile accidents, ATV accidents, any recreational type activity. What can we do to help reduce those accidents out there? And one of the proven side benefits of this law is that it provides an additional measure of safety when people are transporting firearms in a motor vehicle. You have very close confines, and there's always the potential of an accidental discharge if people aren't constantly practicing firearm safety. If we lose the case piece of it, we take one of those steps out of the safety aspect of it. That reminder to case your firearm before you get into a motor vehicle is a premise that we've been teaching in our youth firearm safety training program in the state of Minnesota for 50 plus years. It's that first step in safety in transporting firearms in a motor vehicle. Always make sure your firearm's unloaded and in a case before you transport in a motor vehicle. Again, first of all, you make sure it's unloaded, and secondly, you put it in a case. It's a two-step process. It's not a very lengthy process. It takes just a few seconds. But it's a very important safety message. It's a reminder out there, that two-step process. If we take out the case portion, and we leave in there and just say that it doesn't have to be cased, what we're going to see is situations like we see in our neighboring states where they do allow firearms to be either loaded in the magazine and in the chamber, or just in the magazine. People are going to forget. People are going to forget. They're going to get lazy. It's just like they get lazy sometimes. We're just going to go down to the corner and get a gallon of milk. They don't put their seatbelt on. But they're just as likely to get killed going down to the corner to get a gallon of milk as they are if they don't always practice safety with a firearm. I can't say that's going to happen in Minnesota, but knowing, being a conservation officer, checking people in the field, having numerous thousands and thousands of contacts with people out recreating, the chances of that happening are going to be greatly increased. It's just that they're going to be in a hurry, say, we're just going a couple miles down the road, and not take time to unload their firearm. And in that one time that they do that, and they have an accidental discharge in the firearm, of a firearm in that motor vehicle, chances are, one, that they're going to seriously injure or kill somebody, and that chances are that that person is going to be a friend or a family member, because that's who people always hunt with. They hunt with their close friends and family members. Again, can I say that's going to happen for sure? No, but if we look at the statistical evidence in our neighboring states where they don't have a case requirement, we can see on page 5, following page, that they have a much higher incident rate involving accidents taking place in or around motor vehicles. If you look at the IHEA data, and we're just taking all the accidents that happened in and around motor vehicles, the 10-year period from 98 to 2007. North Dakota has a no case law, and the firearms can also have a round in the magazine, or rounds in the magazine. It can't be loaded in the chamber. Look at South Dakota can, because the firearm can also be loaded in the magazine and loaded in the chamber. We look at Wisconsin. Wisconsin's case law pretty much mirrors what Minnesota is. You unload it, put it in a case before you transport it in a motor vehicle. And same thing with Iowa. Again, their statute pretty much mirrors Minnesota's as far as their case gun statute. If we look at the statistics from the IHEA from North Dakota, South Dakota, and you compare those against those other states that have a case law requirement, you can see that there's a much higher frequency of accidents involving firearms in and around motor vehicles when they're transported without a case. If you look at the accident rate per 1,000 hunters, the bottom graph on the page, you can see a drastic difference if we compare that accident rate per 100,000 hunters. Any questions you have at this time regarding the statistical data? As we continue through the reports here, the original question was that we were supposed to prepare a report that related to predator hunting in Minnesota. Well, hunting is hunting. When you have firearms, if you're out hunting, it doesn't matter whether you're hunting deer, coyote, pheasants.
if you're handling firearms, loading and unloading them, transporting them in motor vehicles, it doesn't make any difference what type of animal you're involved in hunting. We went back to and answered the specific questions that were presented in the original House file that was presented by Chairman Dill, Representative Cornish, to help kind of flesh out some of those original questions that you had. And we're looking at those, again, in the remainder of the report here. Is there any evidence that more accidents occur loading or unloading firearms or putting firearms in and out of cases than would occur if firearms were not required to be cased? There's no specific data on this. There's not been a study done by the International Hunter Ed Association. There has not been a study done by any entity that we could find that would specifically answer this question. What it boils down to is any time that firearms are handled and someone's going to go hunting with them, they're going to need to be loaded. And at some time, they're going to have to be unloaded. And we teach that as one of the foundations or building blocks of our youth firearm safety training program in Minnesota. When do you load your firearm? When do you unload your firearm? We don't teach to load firearms in or around motor vehicles.
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
Well, quite a bit of your testimony has been talking about people forgetting. And they're going to forget that almost everything that they, you know, everything the report says is based on somebody poaching. That's an illegal act. Forgetting. They're going to forget to unload their motor. Do you think that they're going to forget to unload their gun? I mean, you train them not to know when to load and unload their gun. And so it seems that there must be some failings there if we're going to have accidents. I mean, I don't agree with the much of the report. I mean, I see in the report talking about people getting stopped on the highway in a domestic abuse case, and they had an uncased firearm. I don't know that that has anything to do with hunting. And I'd like to have, I think that the, unless you have something specific about the question that you'd like to say, we're going to run out of time here in 15 minutes.
Well, I'd like to address
like
that,
to have,
that what you just specifically addressed to me about people.
Could I have,
that?
I'm in the chair
yes.
seat here, and you can wait till I finish.
Yes.
Thank you. I'd like to have at least 10 minutes for our to have some questions asked and maybe have someone that's interested testify for and against this. So if you could let the members can read this, if you could kind of wrap that up.
To
go ahead.
To address your concerns about people forgetting, and is our safety training program sufficient to keep people from forgetting? Well, we have to remember that a large percentage of our citizens have never taken a firearm safety training program. We only require persons born after December 31st, 1979, to have hunter education or firearm safety training course prior to buying a hunting license. So we have a lot of the citizenry out there who are hunters that have never actually went through a firearm safety training course. And a lot of times those people are the mentors and models for the young people starting out and may not be demonstrating the right way, the wrong way, whatever way we think it should be. We think it should be the safe way. But we do have the opportunity to mold those youth out there before they go hunting to learn the right way, but they may have already learned the wrong way from someone who's an adult out there who wasn't required to take the course. I don't have any more specifics. As you said, the report is here for the committee members to read. If you have any specific questions for me,
okay, we'll first take Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Captain, thank you for the report. I think it gives us good reason to know that we don't want to enact the laws in South Dakota or North Dakota. I think it's important to know that's not what the proposal that's going to be before us. The proposal before us is to do some common sense stuff about when people are actually out in the field hunting. But But my question centers around all of your argument, clearly, and all of the data in the report I read last night deals with people that would be breaking either current Minnesota law or were breaking it when they did what happened, or another state in actually in South Dakota and North Dakota, they might not have been breaking, well, in North Dakota they were, but in South Dakota they might not have been breaking a law just in the fact that they had one in the chamber. My point is your examples are all for people that would be breaking the law either under current law or the future law. I actually think one of the biggest challenges for our CEOs is when they walk up to hunters and are challenged, as you said, many of us, though I'm not in the group, I did take gun safety, many folks that didn't take gun safety and may not properly, as you know, especially pheasant hunting, it's amazing the different groups of people that you can get and how used they are to handling guns. My point is if you were to walk up to, if you were behind a vehicle and you were concerned about that vehicle, and pulled them over and raced up to the vehicle and came up, and in one vehicle, you know, there was some shuffling and maybe a couple folks in the car, and you walked up to them, and in one case they had a couple of the rag cases that were tied shut, or if you walked up to the car and there was two guns with the actions open, and you could clearly see there wasn't any shells in either one of the, or the chamber or the magazine. Which gun's got a bigger chance of going off when it gets handled by the person?
Well, under the scenario you gave, there's all kinds of things that could have been taking place there. If it's clear to all the individuals in that vehicle that all of the firearms have been properly unloaded, everyone's looked at them, checked them, to make sure that everybody has done their job diligently and properly, there would be no safety problem there if everyone has done what they're supposed to do.
Mr. Chair, well, Captain, my point is the fact that a gun is in a car, uncased, doesn't make it less safe. It may actually make it more safe. Our standard procedure in hunting is to open the action when we're not going to be in the act of hunting.
Yes.
And we expect that.
That's
including
a for firearm safety program.
One moment, please.
Mr. Chair.
Sir, you can go through the chair. When you want to speak, you can go through me first. Okay, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My point, Captain, is the fact that the gun is in the car does not make it less safe being out of a case. I actually, you made the point yourself, Captain, you said we expect people to remember two things. Unload the gun and case it up. Let's just unload the gun, open the action so we can see what's going on and we know the gun is safe. I believe it's actually better when it's open and you can see it. I am just a fanatic about where it's pointed and where the muzzle is and all that. I think this gives us an opportunity to be safer. Your argument that is it going to allow have a difference in poaching, that's a different discussion altogether. Do we need to increase the poaching penalties or whatever? Let's have that discussion, but that's separate of this discussion. This discussion is about people in the field hunting, and why are we making them go through this hoop? I don't believe, Mr. Chair, it's about safety. I can't make the connection. It takes a round in the chamber to hurt somebody, and nowhere are we talking about that. And actually, I believe we open it to where we could open the action and see it in the vehicle. Whether you're riding in the back or in the cab, where you may put it in the cab. I believe this is an opportunity for us to be more transparent, for people to understand, be more simple, and as Mr. Bostic said earlier, let's encourage people to be part of the field.
And Representative McNamara, if the testifier stated that, what if someone forgets? And I think people do forget. I forget all the time. I don't even know where I'm going after this meeting at the moment. But if they forget and then they put it in a case loaded, I think it's even more dangerous than if it were unloaded or if it were loaded and laying in the car, because some other hunter in the party would look and see that the chamber was, that the action was closed or something like that, where when it's in a case, person could be walking around in the case and the gun could go off just because it was bumped. I agree with you, Mr. Hamlin.
Chairman Dill, Representative McNamara. The situation that you outlined, yes. If the action's open and everyone thoroughly checks their firearm before they put it in the motor vehicle and everyone knows that everyone has done a proper safety check, is just as safe as a cased gun. The situation outlined by Representative Dill, Chairman Dill, if someone does forget to properly unload their firearm, they leave a round in the chamber. Maybe they take five rounds. They've got a shotgun that's capable of holding five rounds, and they take out four because they were standing around talking with their friends about the previous punch or whatever it has to be, got distracted. And that's typically where these situations happen. People aren't intentionally typically riding around with loaded firearms. They forget sometimes, and it's because of distractions. The chances of that firearm discharging when it's in the case, especially if it's in a hard side case, are much less than if that firearm is riding around loose in a motor vehicle. It's going to depend on how much physical control that person puts on that firearm. We've set it back behind the back seat. Let's say they set it in the back seat. Firearm's back there, accidentally left a round in there, and also in the back seat is their dog. In Minnesota, in the last 2 years, we've had four people who have been shot by their hunting partner. In this case, it was their dog. Because dogs don't know when a gun is loaded or unloaded. They don't know. They just know it's the thing that makes noise and it's time for them to go retrieve. So situations like that can happen. It's all going to depend on if there's something that can touch that trigger and cause it to accidentally discharge. If we have the steps, steps that we've been teaching for 55 years in the state of Minnesota in our Hunter Education Program, and can see that we have a very, very low accident rate when it comes to firearms and motor vehicles, it tells me that the current law, the way it's written, isn't broken, and it's not making things unsafe.
Okay, Representative.
So my question is, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have two questions. One was, I used to have a single shot 20 gauge that I could take apart and into three pieces, and my understanding is doing that isn't allowed anymore. I'm just wondering why. Instead of putting a case, you just take the gun apart into three pieces and or more. That used to be Minnesota law, didn't it?
Mr. Hamlin.
It would be if it was placed in the trunk of a motor vehicle. It would be lawful. I'm not sure why that changed. To me, if a firearm is made incapable of firing, it should be safe. And I can't go back into the history of why that specific portion of the law changed to not allow that. But it is allowed in the rearmost portion of the motor vehicle, or in case it are closed in the trunk, that would be allowed.
And then secondly, I'm not an archery hunter, but I'm trying to figure out the archery piece of it, and maybe Representative Tao has a crossbow question, but I look at 97BO.05, so it's unstrung and completely contained in a case. So if it's just unstrung, I'm looking for the rationale on that as well, why just having an unstrung bow could not.
I would agree with you, again, that unstrung is safe. And we go back to the piece on archery equipment in motor vehicles. It was put in there more as to prevent poaching than as a safety-related issue. It was all poaching-related.
Okay. And so now we have Representative Cornish.
No, Mr. Chair, we're running out of time, and I want to preface my comments with nothing. Mike Hammer, Officer Hammer, is a longtime friend of mine, and I'm not saying it's derogatory about the DNR or Mr. Hammer, but I disagree with almost every point in the report. And then just real quickly, I think it was unfair to compare loaded with unloaded states. We have nothing to do with a loaded gun here. The only two times I've ever had a discharge of a firearm in a motor vehicle while I was a CO was when they were trying to stuff it back into a case when I was locking up. And the point is, you can say, well, yeah, because you didn't unload it, blah, 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 when you didn't have it out of the case. The point is, somebody's going to have a loaded gun or shoot out of a window, it's going to do it anyway. It's a predisposed disposition to violate the law. This little uncased, if he's thinking about shooting something illegally out the window, he sure wasn't worried about the case law. So I think it's an unfair comparison there. And I think we're dumbing down the hunter in the report when we say that automatically that hunter's going to violate the law just because the gun is laying there uncased. I think that's not thinking very much of our hunters today. Just because you've got an uncased gun laying there doesn't mean that they're going to violate the law. So it's kind of a slam to the hunter. The other thing is, North and South Dakota and Arizona say it isn't an officer safety issue. The chiefs of Arizona and South Dakota both wrote me a letter saying that they didn't believe it was an officer safety issue. And they've had this for years and years. And the problem with the statistics you showed here, the accidents, each one involved a loaded firearm. Our law is we aren't going to propose a loaded firearm. And I can't swallow the fact after 22 years as a game warden that we're forcing them to keep a loaded gun just because we're letting them have an uncased gun. I don't think they're going to go that route. I think they're training. One guy said, the South Dakota warden said he'd been talking to an Iowa conservation officer that has a law similar to ours. And that officer told him, because of the case law, he found officers in Iowa running up to the vehicle and forgetting about officer safety so they could catch him taking the gun out of the case so they could give him a citation. And I don't mean that in a bad way, like you're trying to pin somebody for a violation, but it made an officer safety issue more with the case. So I actually think it could possibly be safer with an uncased gun law. The guy in Arizona, they allow loaded guns, and he says he'd rather see the gun there than have it hidden under a blanket or in a case. If you see the gun there, and they're used to it. I think we've got this paranoia culture about guns. Just we see a gun and we get alarmed where we shouldn't. And, gosh, I've had loaded guns handing in and out of the window for years, and I've never been afraid of a person, a law-abiding citizen, just a violator. And so I have a problem with just about every step of the report. It just infers that the hunter is going to turn into a violator because we give an option. And law enforcement, I think, and myself included, sometimes falls into the trap that we think we have to protect people from themselves, and we don't. We got to give them enough credit. And we all remember the Personal Protection Act when the sheriff and the chief got up and they said there was going to be more road rage because of a gunman's presence. There was going to be more bar rage. There was going to be more domestic. And all these bad things just for the existence of a firearm. And not one of those things happened. I think we're falling into that same trap here, thinking of a scary gun culture. And so we'll talk more about that when the bill comes up. Trying to get in the comments before the end of the period here.
Thank you. Anyone else have any comments they'd like to, or questions? Okay, I along with Representative Cornish, think that the report, I disagree with most of what is in the report myself. I really, really take it personally to an extent that this bill is a platform for illegal activity. This bill has nothing to do with illegal activity. This bill has everything to do with people legally handling firearms. And as a waterfowl hunter, time and time and time again, maybe 100 or more times, I've shot at a duck and not killed it. Had to uncase my gun, get in the boat, or if I was in a boat, case the gun before I started. And sometimes I've cased and uncased the gun two or three times trying to dispatch the duck. And I mean, that is a huge problem. And just, in my view, asking for a problem. Because now the person doesn't want to get a ticket for uncased, so he puts his gun in the case, could put the gun in his case loaded, but still have it in the case, and so the conservation officer that's on shore might see it in the case and not follow up. Just a huge problem. This would be fixed. I've been pheasant hunting in Minnesota this last year, actually the very first time ever, because I spend most of my time in South Dakota and North Dakota pheasant hunting or duck hunting. And when we were picked up at the end of a CRP field to go back to the other end to make a drive, in the same field, by the way, there were 8 people got in the back of a pickup truck, all with unloaded guns, but uncased. And we were on a motor vehicle. Every one of those hunters, as I understand it, was illegal. I go to a trap shooting club. There are ATVs running all over the gun club. Class 2, generally, ATVs, with 5, 6, 8 Perazzi shotguns on them, all uncased. Illegal. Someone is in their motorhome going down the road, going from the Minnesota State trap shoot to the Kansas State trap shoot, and they're cleaning their Perazzi or their Ludic or their gun in their motorhome, and they're illegal. I mean, there's just so many things. Representative McNamara told me of instances where someone makes a deer drive, and they go down a half a mile through the woods, and they get to the end, and a pickup comes to pick them up, but their cases are a half a mile away. And so now they have to walk back that half mile to get their case so that they can properly and legally take care of the gun. This bill is not about people doing things illegal. We educate people to do things legally, and then we catch and prosecute illegal people. Now, although I've never had a violation of any game law in Minnesota, or for that matter in any other state or province that I can recall, I don't think I've ever had one. I follow the laws, and it's a lot simpler not to have the gun in the case when you're in South Dakota. I don't even load the gun in South Dakota, even though it's uncased. I don't load it. Some people do, but that's their law. This isn't changing the fact that you can't shoot from a road or a right of way at big game. This doesn't change the fact that you can shoot a small game from a road right of way, not from a vehicle. You can shoot over, across, down the center line for that matter. None of those laws are being changed. This is simply about when the bill comes before us and relative to this report, an uncased firearm that is not loaded, that is able to be transported in a car. And lastly, this doesn't mean that the fine officer here, in his exemplary safety program, can't teach people that they can case the gun. This doesn't mean that you can't case the gun. It just says that you can have it uncased. So if someone feels that it's a safer situation in their case, they can case the gun. It doesn't prohibit that. It just allows. It's more permissive. It makes hunting easier. In my view, it makes it safer, like Representative McNamara said. And that's the reason that the bill was brought forward. And frankly, members of the committee, and anyone interested in the public, I brought this up in 2003, not as a bill, just as an idea. And Representative Cornish and I went toe-to-toe on this bill. It was an amendment. I mean, we went toe-to-toe. I told him to start thinking like a constituent instead of a conservation officer. But, now here we are today working on it in unison because we've thought it through and we've seen it in practicality. And, I mean, what we have here is a culture that's been developed for a long time. That doesn't mean it's right. Let's look at a thousand other cultures that have been for thousands of years, but that didn't mean it was right. So I really feel bad for the hunters that have been portrayed in this report, as soon as they can have an uncased, unloaded or an uncased firearm, that they're going to start poaching. Or I really feel bad for people or officers that might think because a legal, law-abiding person has an uncased gun that they might be in jeopardy, when there's no evidence to support that in any way. So I've given my speech on this, and the bill has been introduced. It's going to have a significant amendment. We've listened to a whole lot of people over a whole lot of issues, and thanks to Ms. Taylor, she has spent copious amounts of time crafting language to fix all of the problems that I know have been identified at this point, and that's the bill that will come before this committee at some point. And I invite the department to come and take it apart, just like we've taken apart and been kind while doing it, their report. So anyone else have anything on this issue? Okay, this meeting is adjourned.